This program is provided by a trusted partner of the church and is educational, inspirational, and uplifting. It does not necessarily represent the official position of the church.
There's a lot of value in studying the lives of people who are little known so far as the major outlines of church history is concerned. Some of the ordinary people are people who were close to Joseph Smith, but just not well known in the main books that are written about church history.
Next on the Joseph Smith Papers, William Clayton and the family of Joseph Knight.
From the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon Channel now presents the Joseph Smith Papers.
K-Jazz Television, in cooperation with the Church History Department of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, presents this weekly series highlighting the research of scholars and historians as they prepare for the publication of the Joseph Smith Papers. And now your host, Glenn Rawson.
Tonight, we continue our series on early converts to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We begin with a devoted English convert named William Clayton.
James B. Allen.
Now, most people know William Clayton, if they know his name at all, because of the fact that he was the author of the famous LDS hymn, Come, Come, Ye Saints. Some people also know that he was a scribe to the prophet Joseph Smith. Some people know that he was also one of those men who contributed to the making of the famous pioneer odometer that you see pictures of all the time. But what people don't know is that William Clayton had much, much more to do with Joseph Smith and the history of the church than just those three things. Just to give you a little brief outline of many of the things that he did throughout his life. He was a missionary and a branch president and a member of the mission presidency in Great Britain. He was a scribe to the prophet Joseph Smith. He recorded many of Joseph Smith's revelations. He was a great record keeper. He kept his own journals, but also many of the important records of the church that we still use quite often. He was on a committee to help prepare Joseph Smith's history. Later on, he kept the minutes for the 1847 Pioneer Company that crossed the plains to Utah. He kept the journals for Heber C. Kimball. He drew maps for Willard Richards. As I said before, he was the co-inventor of the Pioneer Odometer. He published an emigrant guide that became important not only for Mormon emigrants to Utah, but for other emigrants who were going across the Oregon Trail to California and to Oregon. William Clayton was born in 1814 in Penwortham, England. He grew up there. He went to church in St. Mary's Church in Penwortham. He married a young lady by the name of Ruth Moon.
Then in 1837, Elders Heber C. Kimball and Orson Hyde, on the first apostolic mission to Great Britain, met the Claytons.
Ruth was the first one to join the church. It took William just a little bit longer, but one night at 11 o'clock at night, he finally decided he was going to be baptized. So he had Heber C. Kimball take him out to the River Ribble, and at 11 o'clock that night, the date was October 21st, 1837, he was baptized in the River Ribble.
Following his conversion, William wrote this in his diary.
I feel I am not my own. I am bought with a price, even the blood of Jesus Christ, and as a servant I must soon give up my account. I desire and strive, brethren, to keep my account right with the Lord every day, that I may meet him with joy. Well, that was the spirit he carried with him throughout his life as he did his missionary work and other kinds of things for the church.
In 1840, the 12 returned to England and announced the gathering to Zion.
They sell practically everything in order to get enough money to emigrate and set up their residences when they get to the United States. Well, the sailing was delayed, but then on September 5th, just as they thought they were going to sail again, William took his family to the ship, and his mother-in-law did something that he didn't like. But this shows you the influence of women on history. His mother-in-law said, you have got to come with us. And William didn't want to go with them. He wanted to do his missionary work in Birmingham. So he said, no, I can't go. Whereupon his mother-in-law went to see John Taylor, a member of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. And the next thing William Clayton knew, John Taylor sent word that, yes, he had to emigrate too. So 3 days later, William Clayton, with 205 other members of the church, was aboard the ship North America, sailing for America. They took 33 days to cross the Atlantic Ocean to New York. From New York, they made their way through a circuitous route up the Hudson River, across the Erie Canal to Buffalo, across the Great Lakes, and finally down to Chicago, and then on a little boat that they rented down the Rock River to the Mississippi River, and then down the Mississippi River where they'd camp at nights along the shore. On the last day, November 24th, William Clayton got up early, and instead of getting back on the boat, he was so eager to get to Commerce, as it was called then, and later became known as Nauvoo, that he walked the last 9 miles to Commerce. And then he wrote in his diary, and I have to read one more thing from his diary. Thus ended a journey of over 5,000 miles, having been exactly 11 weeks and about 10 hours. See how good a record keeper he was? 11 weeks and about 10 hours between leaving Liverpool and arriving at our journey's end.
Upon meeting Joseph Smith, William Clayton wrote back to his friends in England. This is what he said.
If I were in England, he wrote to a friend in Manchester in 1840, I would raise my voice and testify that Joseph Smith is a man of God, which will roll forth unto the end of the earth and gather together all the good there is on the earth. He is no friend of iniquity, but cuts at it whenever he sees it. He has a great measure of the Spirit of God. He says, I am a man of like passions with yourselves, but truly, I wish I was such a man. I thought that was a wonderful statement about the impact of Joseph Smith on William Clayton. Later on, in March of 1842, he wrote to William Hardman in England, For me to write anything concerning the character of President Joseph Smith would be superfluous. All evil reports concerning him I treat with utter contempt. I will add that the more I am with him, the more I love him. The more I know of him and the more confidence I have in him. I am sorry that people should give heed to evil reports concerning him when we know all the great service he has rendered the church.
Then, September the 3rd, 1842, the prophet Joseph Smith called William Clayton into his office and he said this,
Brother Clayton, I want you to take care of the records and the papers, and from this time I appoint you temple recorder. And when I have any revelations to write, you shall write them. Well, there couldn't have been anything more satisfying to William Clayton because he was already so enamored with Joseph Smith. He developed a love and a reverence for him that would dominate the rest of his life. Just before Joseph Smith died, just a few days before he died, he knew he was going to his death. William Clayton must have been horrified when Joseph Smith called him in and said, I want you to take care of the records of the church, records of the kingdom, as he put it. I'm afraid they'll fall into wrong hands if something happens to me. So I want you either to find somebody who will take care of them or burn them. Among the things that he took across the Mississippi River with him in February when he left Nauvoo were all the records of the church. And that was one of his heavy responsibilities. Well, William Clayton wrote some letters for Joseph Smith just before Joseph Smith was martyred. And when he woke up early on the morning of the day of the martyrdom, William Clayton was stunned to hear of the death of the prophet. Even though he knew the prophet had predicted his own death, it was a tremendous sadness to William Clayton, as it was to so many other people.
February 1846, the exodus of Nauvoo. William Clayton was among the first of those to leave, interestingly, leaving behind his wife, Diantha. And therein lies a famous story.
Diantha was pregnant, and she was ill. She just was not able to travel. So he left her with her parents and planned to go back to Nauvoo and pick her up once he heard that the baby had been born. They were camped on at Locust Creek out on the plains of Iowa. And the night before had been a terribly, terribly bitter night. Tents had blown down. Animals had got in in some of the tents. The cattle had tromped over some of the tents. It had been snowing. It was really a terrible morning. But that morning, William Clayton got word that Diantha had had the baby. And so the day became not a discouraging day, but an encouraging day for him. And he sat down by his wagon, as I picture the incident, and began to write the verses of a song. Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. And so it was on the occasion of Diantha giving birth to her first child and only child that William Clayton wrote, Come, come, ye saints, out there on the cold, dreary plains of Iowa.
Then in the 1847 journey to the valley, it was William Clayton who was assigned to keep track of the miles covered by the company each day.
Well, how are you going to do that? They didn't have speedometers like we have today. So he came up with the idea of measuring the circumference of a wagon wheel. And he tied a rag on the wagon wheel and spent all day counting the number of times that the wagon wheel went around so that he could then calculate the number of miles they had traveled. Well, he finally got tired of that. And so he suggested the creation of a machine with cogs that would turn as the wagon wheel turned and with a series of cogs that would automatically count the revolutions of the wagon wheel. Orson Pratt made the plans, and then Appleton Harmon constructed it. So three men were involved in the making of the famous Pioneer odometer. And on the basis of that, William Clayton kept a more accurate record of the mileage crossing the plains.
Once in the Salt Lake Valley, William Clayton continued the pattern of faithful service. At one point, he wrote this.
Those who came to this land must set their minds firm to come through all and not flinch if death should stare them in the face. The Lord calls for valiant-hearted men who are not afraid to die. And that describes William Clayton. He was valiant. He was not afraid to die. But he felt that his most important mission was to bear witness of the restoration of the gospel through Joseph Smith. William Clayton died on December 4, 1879, at age 65. And at that point, he still had four living widows, including his first wife, Ruth, 33 living children, ages 10 to 43, and one child on the way. He had been a faithful Latter-day Saint all of his life. He had had all kinds of problems, all kinds of disappointments, but the greatest highlight in his life was the fact that he had been close to Joseph Smith.
And now we come to a family little known to most of us, yet they were among those that Joseph Smith counted as his most faithful friends, the Knight family.
William G. Hartley.
In the parade of associates of Joseph Smith, the Knight family should be put near the front. The Knight family met Joseph Smith before he met Oliver Cowdery, before he met the Whitmers. They met Joseph Smith before he received the plates from the angel Moroni. So as far as associates of Joseph Smith go, they are among the earliest, and they also are among the longest faithful, stalwart followers of the prophet Joseph. Not far from Binghamton, New York, along the Susquehanna River, is a township called Colesville. And the Knight family were living there when they met Joseph Smith in 1826. Joseph Knight Sr. had 140 acres of land and had a mill, and he wanted to hire somebody to help him. Joseph Knight Jr., in later years, wrote this. My father hired many hands. In 1826, he hired Joseph Smith Jr. Joseph and I worked together and slept together. My father and Joseph said Joseph was a man of truth and the best hand he had ever hired. He was about 21 years of age at the time. I think it was in November that he made known to us that he had seen a vision, that a personage had appeared to him and told him where there was a gold book of ancient date buried, and that if he would follow the directions of the angel, he could get it. We were told this in secret. Newell Knight, who was 5 years older than Joseph Smith at that time, said, quote, "The family was frequently visited by Joseph Smith, who would entertain us with accounts of the wonderful things which had happened to him. We were very deeply impressed with the truthfulness of his statements concerning the plates of the Book of Mormon, which had been shown him by an angel of the Lord." But they keep track of what's happening with Joseph Smith. So in 1827, in September, when Joseph Smith is supposed to receive the plates from the angel, who is at the Joseph Smith home but Joseph Knight Sr.? And when Joseph Smith and Emma go out to the hill that's later called Cumorah, they go in Joseph Knight's wagon using Joseph's team.
In that first winter in Harmony, Pennsylvania, when Joseph was attempting to translate the plates of the Book of Mormon, he and Emma were destitute. Father Knight said this,
"He could not translate but little, being poor, and nobody to write for him but his wife, and she could not do much and take care of her house. And he, being poor, and no means to live by working. His wife's father and family were against him and wouldn't help him. He and his wife came up to see me the first of the winter, 1828, and told me his case. I let him have some little provisions and some few things out of the store, a pair of shoes, and $3 in money to help him a little." When the Book of Mormon came off the press in March of 1830, Father Knight, again, was in Palmyra for that occasion. When the church was organized on April 6, 1830, Father Knight was there, and according to a list that, as accurate as we can make the list of the 60 people who were in attendance, roughly 60 people, about one-third of those were Knight relatives from Colesville that had come up for the occasion. Father Knight asked for a revelation. That is, he asked Joseph Smith, "What does the Lord want of me?" And Joseph Smith then inquired of the Lord and received a revelation for Father Knight that basically said, "A marvelous work and a wonder is about to come forth, and you need to help push it along."
And then on one occasion when Joseph was ministering to the saints in Colesville,
Newell Knight, after Joseph Smith had been preaching, went out into the woods and promised Joseph he would try to pray vocally, and he just struggled with it. And when he came back in, he was distraught, and he seemed to be overcome and started to be very anxious. And Joseph Smith discerned that he was possessed by an evil spirit. And Joseph Smith knew that in the New Testament church, those in authority could cast out devils. And he told Newell, he said, "If you have faith, maybe we can cast this demon out." And Newell said, "Do it." And Joseph cast out the evil spirit. Newell said he saw the spirit depart from him. Joseph Smith was astounded at this miracle, and he calls it in his history the first miracle in the church. At the church's first real conference in June 1830, Newell Knight was present and had an experience similar to what Stephen the Martyr experienced. Newell Knight said, "A vision of futurity also burst upon me, and I saw represented the great work which through the instrumentality of Joseph Smith was to be accomplished. I saw the heavens opened. I beheld the Lord Jesus Christ seated on the right hand of the Majesty on high, and it was made plain to my understanding that the time would come when I would be admitted into his presence to enjoy his society forever and ever."
The Knight family and all their connections, well, that amounted to about 60 people, and they comprised the Colesville branch. When the revelation came commanding the church to move to Ohio, they moved en masse.
There's a property difficulty that develops there, and in essence, they will be sent on to Missouri to be the first group, if you will, of Latter-day Saint converts sent to establish Zion in Jackson County, Missouri. When the Knight family reached Missouri as part of the first settlements, if you will, in the summer of 1831, Joseph Knight Sr.'s wife, Polly Peck, died. And she was the first Mormon, if you will, in the Promised Land, in Zion, to die. When the Saints were kicked out of Jackson County, the Knight family scrambled across the Missouri River in November of 1833 and struggled to come up with tents and housing and find a new setup. One of the victims of that exposure of being kicked out of Jackson County was Newell Knight's wife, Sally. And she is buried on one of the bluffs overlooking the Missouri River, just across the river, actually, from Jackson County. So Newell is left a widower. He will then go to Kirtland. He will lodge with his old friend, Hiram Smith, his wife, Jerusha, that run a boarding house in Kirtland. Newell meets and falls in love with a young woman named Lydia Goldthwaite Bailey. She has been deserted by an abusive husband, and she's had two children die. And she notices that Newell, who's quite a bit older than her, is also without a spouse and has a child that needs to be raised. And their sympathy for each other blossoms into a love match that Joseph Smith will culminate in the marriage of these two by priesthood authority, the first priesthood marriage, if you will, in the restored church.
When the Saints were driven out of far west Missouri in 1839, going to Quincy, again, the Knight family followed faithfully.
In Nauvoo, the Knight family did whatever work they had to do in terms of their careers. Again, Joseph Knight Jr. and Newell were millers and helped Nauvoo with its flour supply and its milling of grains and so forth. When Joseph Smith was murdered, there is no more profound reaction to his death than what Newell Knight expressed in his journal. "Oh, how I loved those men and rejoiced under their teachings. It seems as if all," he underlines all, "is gone, and as if my very heartstrings will break. And were it not for my beloved wife and dear children, I feel as if I have nothing to live for, and would rejoice to be with them in the courts of glory. But I must live and labor and try to do good and help build up the kingdom of our God here on the earth. And I pray God, my Father, that I may be reconciled unto my lot and live and die a faithful follower of the teachings of our murdered prophet and patriarch." During the exodus from Nauvoo, in which the Knight family and the extended family participated well, Father Knight made it as far as Mount Pisgah, and he died that winter at Mount Pisgah.
Then, January 1847, in Nebraska,
Newell becomes ill with pneumonia and will die. And he is buried, along with about 20 others, up there on the Niobrara River. And one of his sons, who was born in Nauvoo, was Jesse Knight. Later, Jesse Knight will become a millionaire in Utah, and after the turn of the, after 1900, he will go back to Niobrara and set up a wonderful obelisk honoring Newell Knight and the others who died at Niobrara during that winter of 1846-1847. Lydia is then left a widow. She has six kids and one on the way. She is struggling to make a go of it, returns to winter quarters, and on two occasions when she becomes very discouraged, Newell will visit her. Her own writings indicate that Newell visited her and comforted her and promised her that he would watch over her for the rest of her life. She will then go west in 1850 and become one of the pioneers in Utah. Out of this Knight tribe of followers and believers, none became one of the three witnesses. None became one of the eight witnesses. None became members of the Quorum of the Twelve or of the First Presidency. And yet, below those high levels of church operations, they were faithful in many callings.
Next week on the Joseph Smith Papers, Martin Harris and the family of John Johnson. I'm Glenn Rawson. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to the Joseph Smith Papers here on the Mormon Channel, a production of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.